So this is joint work with Pierre Clavier, who's here, two people who are not here, Li Guo and Bin Zhang. Li Guo is based in the States, Rutgers University at Newark, Bin Zhang at Sichuan University in Chengdu. The title contains many words, maybe too many. One of the essential words is multivariable. Another important word is renormalization, and I'm sure each of you has her or his own view on renormalization, and we can discuss that afterwards if necessary. Now, because there are many variables, you can have linear relations between them, and that's what you see with linear poles. The poles will of some meromorphic germs that will arise from the singularities. These will have be related by linear conditions, and I want to relate this again with the geometry of cones. So it goes across topics. You'll also see some multi-zeta functions along the way. So let me see if I get this right. Yeah. So why use many variables? And why renormalize? So there, I'll be slow. Tell me if you just want me to skip this, because maybe it will be useful, because I'll be talking not only of Feynman integrals, which I assume everybody here is familiar with, but also of discrete sums like zeta functions. And that's what I start with, a zeta function, the well-known zeta function. So we know that we can expect a pole at s equal 1. And I would like to relate this to the fact that this integral here, which is an uninteresting Feynman integral, also presents divergence the way it is here written. And these two things seemingly from different parts, one from mathematics, the other one from physics, are in fact very much related, at least to my eyes and to the eyes of, I think, of my collaborators. And like a physicist would do, but not only, we know that Riemann did that, Euler before him. You want to extract from these divergent expressions, you would like to extract a finite quantity for physicists, because you want to measure, you cannot measure infinities, you want to measure finite quantities. And so how would you do that? There are many ways. One very straightforward way would be what I think a physicist would call minimal subtraction, taking the minimal amount away so that you are left with something convergent. And let's view this as the counter term, and then remains a finite part. I'm trying this out. It's not good? Yeah? Okay, I'm practicing. And so now there's a holomorphic part, and we're just going to evaluate it at s equal 1, and we get this, what I'll call regularized zeta value at 1. Now, let's do the same thing with the Feynman integral, the toy model Feynman integral. And for that, we have to, we're using a cutoff procedure, there would be other ways of doing so in polar coordinates or spherical coordinates. And we see appearing two terms, which we might want to get rid of. Here, there is some ambiguity. Should we could just as well have multiplied r by 2, and then we would maybe not have known what to do with log of 2r, but that's maybe another question that we don't want to raise today. Anyway, if we do it this way quite naively, sorry, so I'm not quite, oops, I'm not quite experienced yet, then we get this finite term, okay? Okay, but as I just said, this is quite arbitrary. Now, there is the way it's written here, the two things look quite similar, and indeed, that's how we want to view them, as a similar procedure. But now, this was just in one variable. The sum was just an ordinary sum. The integral was an ordinary integral. What about if we now take products, just products? Let's see what happens. The question could be, and I made a decision here, I first took the product, the square, and then took the counter terms away, but I could have done it the opposite way, taken the counter terms away first, and then taken the square. And we'd like to see whether I would have got the same thing. Same thing for this integral, which we had earlier on. I could take the counter terms out first and then take the square, or the opposite. So here I'm using this notation with a bar to denote the finite part once I've taken out all the divergences in the cutoff parameter R. Okay, so these are questions. Is that the right thing to do? Is it not? Everyone has their own idea about this. Let's see what we can do. The problem is, and I'll go back to this, is that divergent stuff can combine with convergent stuff to merge into a finite number. And then we're there with finite numbers. We don't know whether we wanted them or maybe didn't want them. And I will later on refer to those as fake finite terms. So why are these issues seem important, not only in physics, where we know, and you better than I'm sure, I'm not a physicist, that multiple integrals arise when you want to compute Feynman diagrams, but there are other setups where they arise. Multi-zeta functions, which are multiple sums, not multiple integrals, multiple sums. They have in common with these Feynman integrals that there are constraints between the variables you're integrating on for Feynman integrals, summing on for multi-zeta functions. I'll come back to those later on. Now, these generalize. Multi-zeta function, let me see. So if you represent, so the zeta function is summing on the integers on this line, then you can consider products, which was the first one we did. And then you're on a grid like that, on a lattice. But then you can decide to take half of this quarter plane. And when you're in doing so, you're summing, like when you're defining a double zeta function. A double zeta function would be this, n1 minus s1, n2 minus s2, maybe the opposite way according to the conventions you choose, zeta s1 s2. And what you're doing, you're summing over this, if I've got it right. So now, having done that, you might be braver and say, okay, well, now I know how to sum on this eighth of the plane, but I could also take it more slanted and see what happens on a cone. And maybe you want to consider a very general cone, not a smooth cone. And this is what happens when you do this first generalization, going from what I call a Chen cone to any cone. So these will be convex polyhedral cones. Now you can do something else. You can view this, this sum, as a nested sum. So n2 is smaller than n1, and then you go on to n1 larger than n2 larger than nk, and you can view this in a different manner, viewing n1 below n2, or the opposite, with the s1, or And here, if you go further, 3 and 3, etc. And what we did here was generalized to any cone. Here we have a ladder tree, and we can decide to add branches. And if we do that, we get what we called branch zeta functions. So we complexify this nested relation into sub-nested constraints. So this leads us to branch zeta functions associated with trees, more general objects than ladder trees, which would just be one branch. Some of you are maybe familiar with Keimer's toy model for quantum field theory. He had integrals associated with trees. So these are examples of setups where you are confronted with this issue of how to renormalize, how to extract divergences of some a priori singular, divergent, multiple integrals, multiple sums with constraints that we'll now review shortly.
Actually,
yes?
Question. So the trees that Keimer is looking at, can one actually relate them to these multi-zetas on cones? I mean, is there a direct connection, or is it just an analogy?
It's just replacing, it's replacing sums by integrals.
Oh, okay, so yeah. This is like very close, actually.
Very close, the integrand is different.
Oh, the integrand is different?
Yes.
But it's not like discretization of, yeah.
No. This is a difficult problem. We've looked at it to discretize Keimer's chain integrals. It's not easy. It's often more difficult to deal with sums than integrals, surprisingly so. So maybe this brings me to another comment. All these multiple integrals and multiple sums have in common, the integrands or the sumands don't look the same, but they all are of the same kind. Technically, they are tensor products of symbols, of pseudo-differential symbols. That's the way you can put them all in one bag. It sounds a bit frightening, but it's just to put them all in one bag, and they're all like that. All the ones one comes across, or I have come across, are of this type. So even if they look different, in the end, they are of the same type, and that's why you can expect the same type of pole structure. Okay, so let's do it naively. We saw we wanted to get rid of poles. So the poles are in red. What we want to keep is in blue. And we just look at it and throw away what's in red. So that looks easy enough. And then we decide that the regularized part at zero is just the limit of the initial function from which we've subtracted the counter terms. And so we've got this blue holomorphic function evaluated as zero. You'll notice that I'm only talking about zero. This is because if I'm at another pole, I can always translate back to zero. So I just focus on germs at zero. Now, the problem is if you do it this way, it doesn't work quite the way maybe you'd like to because of these fake terms I was mentioning. So let me see if I can. Yeah. So those. So you have to think that A1 comes from F1, A2 comes from F2. A1 is in red, it comes from A1 over Z, and A2 from A2 over Z, and now it's going to compensate with H prime 2 of 0 times Z. The Z in blue will simplify with the 1 over Z in red and build this finite part, and the same here. And it's maybe not what you wanted, because brings you away from the product of the regularized part. So when you computed just the product of the zeta functions, you might expect as a finite part of the product of the finite parts. But if you do it that way, it doesn't work, as we all know. So this is just to summarize the origin of the problem. You can just bring it down to this. Z over 1 over Z is 1, and you'd like it to give you 0. So what can we do? There are many very sophisticated ways of dealing with that, and I won't review them all today. I'll just go straight to what we would like to work with. So since we saw that the Z over Z gave us a 1, which we didn't want, we'll call the first Z, Z1, and the second Z, Z2. The first one came from F1, the second one came from F2. So it's very, very naive. We're just not forgetting where they come from. So the big difference here, no, that's not it. The big difference here is that you see there was a Z before there, and a Z before there, now I call them Z1 and Z2. So it's very easy. Having done that, things look better, because then I have, I do see the counter terms, there they are, but now the Z2 over Z1 doesn't give you 1 if you maintain Z2 different from Z1, neither does this one. So they will get thrown away just as this one will get thrown away. So that looks not too bad, but we have to pay a price for that. Namely, we shouldn't forget that this one is different from that one. Otherwise, we shouldn't forget that one is in red and one is in blue, or that, no, maybe better said, one it has an index 1 and the other one has an index 2. They come from two different sources. Now, I put words here, independence, locality, orthogonality, and they're all correct. So we want to maintain these two variables independent of each other. Locality is because they come from two different sources, and it is reminiscent of locality in quantum field theory. Two events should be measured separately. They shouldn't interfere in them. If they're separated in space, the measurement should reflect this separation. Orthogonality, because in practice, it'll often be an orthogonal separation. Something will have nothing to do with the other one because it's in an orthogonal space. Any questions at this stage? So now we have what we wanted, namely that the product, the regularized finite part, or the finite part of, oh, there's a typo here, this should be F2, of the product is indeed the product of the finite parts. And this is something we would like, namely that for independent functions, F1 having nothing to do with F2, here it doesn't look like that because they are both called the same, they should indeed be multiplied in such a way that they should be multiplied and evaluated in such a way that the evaluation on the product factorizes. And this is what we have here. So notice this here. This should be independent of that, and only then can we hope for this. Otherwise, if we forget this, we might be back with our original problem, having forgotten that this one came from another source than that one. So that's the idea. So let's see what we can do as from there. So because we've now introduced several parameters, Z1, Z2, this was only 2, but if we're going to deal with N loops, we'll need N parameters. If we're going to deal with a cone in dimension N, we'll need N parameters. And if we're going to deal with a tree with N nodes or N branches, we'll need the same number of parameters. So this could be, you know, we could hesitate. Shall we do that? Because that's a real effort. And We claim that, yes, it's worth it. This is, by the way, not new. Speer in the 70s had already worked with multi-variables in his analytic approach to renormalization. But it kind of has been maybe not so much in vogue lately, and this is kind of rehabilitating this point of view. So I hope I convince you that it has the advantage that it avoids fake finite terms. It preserves locality in the sense that it factorizes over functions or measurements that come from different sources. And we'll see, I hope, that in the end, it amounts to a minimal subtraction scheme with no sophisticated co-algebraic device like a co-product, Hopf algebra, nothing needed for that. If you leave everything separate, and you have to do that carefully, then you just blindfolded subtract whatever you want to throw away. The other advantage is that it applies to any theory that gives rise to meromorphic germs with linear poles. So you might think, you might say, what theory gives rise to meromorphic germs with linear poles? That's also a question we have. It seems that it's a kind of meta result that whenever you have integrals, multiple integrals or multiple sums over rational domains, which give you the constraints, and I'll give you examples of a tensor product of symbols. If you're not familiar with symbols, you just think rational functions, it would be enough. So it's kind of rational functions over rational domains, then you can expect that. But we don't know how to prove that. Okay, so the price to pay is we have to deal with these meromorphic germs in several variables. You have to get used to it. It took us some time. And also, you have to keep track of locality, of independence. Otherwise, you did all that for nothing. So you should. And this is this requires, you know, defining a new category of locality sets, locality algebras, locality modules, everything, which is rather nice, but it requires some work. So let's get acquainted with meromorphic germs. That's the bad part of the job. They're not that terrible. So they have linear poles. So the bottom part is just a product of linear forms, big Li, okay? And to the power S1, to the power Sn. Upstairs is just a holomorphic germ at zero. We put some small Ls because you can always rewrite your holomorphic germs in germ in terms of some linear forms. But the numerator is kind of a usual thing you expect for meromorphic germs. Again, we're at zero, okay? So I'm just saying again what I've just said. Let's call L of CK the space of such linear forms. And an example so that you have something to have in mind, to keep in mind, is Z1 minus Z2 over Z1 plus Z2. And now I ask you to think for yourself, what finite part would you assign to this at zero? So I'm not telling you what it means at zero, you can decide. And we'll soon declare that this at zero is to be thrown away, is zero, and I'll tell you why in a minute. So I told you that we had to keep in mind locality, independence, orthogonality, whatever. And this we do saying first defining what is the dependent set of a function? Because we'll soon want to say that the dependent set of one function is independent of the dependent set of another. So it's just the vector space spanned by all the linear forms you see there. Quite easy. Okay? So for example, here it would be, if you're in the canonical orthonormal basis of R2, it would be E1, let's call it E1, E2, E1 minus E2, comma, E1 plus E2 as a vector space, okay? So that's what we're looking at. Now, I want them to be independent, and for this, we use an inner product on this space of linear forms. And we say, when the dependent set here is orthogonal to the independent set of F2, the dependent set of F2, then we call them independent. So as you see, it depends, there's lots of words depends here, it depends on an inner product, and that will be very important for what follows. So for example, because all this is very abstract, for example, this one is independent of that one as a linear form. These are meromorphic functions, they're very simple. If you take the canonical inner product, but then you might say, if I take another inner product, they're not orthogonal anymore because E1 minus E2 is orthogonal to E1 plus E2 in the canonical inner product, but not for any other. And this is to keep in mind for future use. Okay, now I said there was a relation to cones, and in fact, cones were our starting point. In fact, it was an article by Nicole Berlin and Michel Verne on equivariant geometry, toric varieties, and the Todd function in that context, which triggered all this. It would be a long story to recall why, but it's no wonder that cones come in. So, what is a polar germ? We have to decide which ones we're going to throw away. We said Z1 minus Z2 over Z1 plus Z2 is maybe something we're going to throw away. Yes, indeed. So those are the polar germs. And what do we ask? So this is just for the moment saying that it's a meromorphic germ with linear poles. And now is the important relation that what is upstairs has nothing to do with what is downstairs. They're irreducible. That's the idea. So the space spanned by the linear forms upstairs is orthogonal to the space spanned by the linear forms downstairs. And again, this depends on Q. Now we'll call M minus, it's in red, the space spanned by these polar germs, it's the ones we're going to throw away. Now we're going to cones, and we're going to call a supporting cone the cone generated by the linear forms in the denominator. This is like when you reduce a fraction, yeah, and you look at what terms are expected in the sum that you're going to obtain. So this is nothing very out of this world. It's very pragmatic. Now, we have to make sure that things remain irreducible. So we'll make sure that the supporting cone of one of our meromorphic germs is not overlapping with the supporting cone of another one. And that's this condition, which looks a bit strange, which says that they should meet along their faces, so minimally, and their union should not contain a line. We don't want too many of these that join and then in the end have a line inside, because we'd have problems. All this is for uniqueness reasons. And then we say, so remember S was this polar germ, and we're going to take families of polar germs whose supporting cones form a family of properly positioned cones, and this will be called properly positioned. I'll give you an example because this is, I think, very abstract, the way it's written. So let me see. And before I do that, let me just state a theorem which says that given a meromorphic germ F, there exists a finite set of polar germs. So polar germs, remember, are those which are irreducible. The top part has nothing to do with the bottom part. Their dependent sets are orthogonal, whose denominators are pairwise not proportional. This is a technical assumption to get uniqueness. There is a holomorphic germ H. Be careful, this one is not the same as those. And what do we obtain in the end? Such that you have this decomposition, F is this H plus, this is the dustbin. This is what we're going to throw away. But we had to decide what we were going to throw away. Now, what's in the dustbin, the way the dustbin looks, is not unique. But the whole thing, the whole dustbin is unique. So the holomorphic germ H is unique, yet the decomposition is not. It's like a Laurent expansion. You can think of it that way. Okay, but that tells you we know what to throw away, and that's what we're going to do very soon. We're going to keep H, because now this, if Q is given, I haven't written here, but there's a inner product, fixed inner product in all this theorem. Once I fix my inner product, this is decomposition is unique, so I know what to throw away, and then I'm going to evaluate this at zero. So it gives me a well-defined procedure. An example of a Laurent expansion, because this decomposition gives you what we call a Laurent expansion. But I've just told you that H is unique, but the SIs are not unique. And that's why there's a C, because it's unique if you assign a given family of supporting cones. So let me make that more precise. So it's a C Laurent expansion of F with C, the supporting cones that you've given yourself, which should be properly positioned otherwise, and they should all be simplicial. Simplicial means that the linear forms that are given by the faces are linearly independent. And then this gives you a well-defined Laurent expansion. So this you can put a bit in parallel with blow-up procedures. It's a bit of this type, but it's a very different point of view because it's all governed by an inner product. So, example, let's start with this one. We don't want this, we declare is not the final form. Why? Because it's not simplicial. You see, there's Z1, Z2, Z1 plus Z2. So there's this, there's that, and there's this. So the cones overlap. So we have to be a little more patient. Then we try this. But this is still not, this is still, so in fact, yes, this was not even simplicial, so it wasn't a linear independent family, E1, E2, E1 plus E2. And now these cones, E1 and E2, E1, E1 plus E2, so E1, E2, E1, E1 plus E2, are not properly positioned because they overlap. So now we're happy. That's if we decide that these are, this is the family of supporting cones, then we indeed have a properly positioned family. So we have E1, E1 plus E2, E1 plus E2, E2. So they indeed are properly positioned. And this is, for example, the Laurent expansion of the first expression. So you see, for this supporting family of supporting cones, I get this Laurent expansion. So it gives you the gist of the idea. Where do the linear poles come from? Do we really have to have them? Yes, because they arise from constraints, different types of constraints. And that's this meta theorem that we don't know how to prove, that if the constraints are rational in a sense, you expect linear poles. but also with specific integrands and summands, which I said have to have something to do with symbols. So the constraints we claim come from the underlying algebraic structure. Graphs, Feynman integrals associated with Feynman graphs in quantum field theory. Conservation of momentum at each vertex of the graph is responsible for linear, or for affine, if you have external momentum as well, for affine conditions between the different momenta. We've simplified here, we've taken linear conditions, but that would be without the external momenta, but they don't really play an essential role in this discussion. Cones. So what is a cone? You can view a cone as the intersection of two half spaces. So again, you've got a hyper surface here a line. You've got, and you're taking they separate your space in two, and you're taking the intersection. So for graphs, it was the intersection of hyperplanes, because these linear constraints or affine constraints define for you hyperplanes. And because you've got several of them, you're on an intersection of hyperplanes. Here, you're on an intersection of half spaces separated by hyperplanes. So it's very, very similar. So these integrals and sums, they arise also in string theory. So it's not just in equivariant geometry where we started from. Trees. So tree structure is a bit different, but again, because of this branching, it gives you kind of linear constraints. So we want to evaluate at zero meromorphic germs that arise from such that present linear poles due to the fact that they arise from such structures which present linear or rational constraints. And for that, we want to use evaluators. So the main work lies in showing that there are linear poles. After that, we can relax and everything is easier. So let me just go into a little more detail, hardly. Feynman integrals, so the constraints are given by conservation of momenta, as I've said, and so they're affine constraints. If you look at them in terms of the internal momenta, they are linear constraints if you look at them in terms of both internal and external momenta. Multi-zeta functions, nested multiple sums, you're on a cone, so this is an intersection of half spaces and conical constraints. And they generalize to conical zeta functions, and you can look at, so here we have a kind of zeta regularization, but you could also look at this type of Laplace regularization. And if you generalize this to this cone, then you obtain exponential sums on polyhedral cones. And this is very much related to the Todd function, which I can't go into now. Okay, so this is more or less what I said. And branched zeta functions is some work we did recently. With tree-like constraints. I don't really know what to call them other than tree-like. And they generalize the nested constraints on ladder trees. Now we have to evaluate them at zero. Now we know where they come from. We want to evaluate them at zero. So we're going to define, and this word, this terminology we got from Speer originally. We've been looking at those for quite a long time, but didn't quite know how to look at them. Now I think we understand better. It's a very simple object. It just says, take a meromorphic germ and assign to it a number. This is what is written there. Meromorphic germ, assign to it a number. Here we have an intermediate step where we assign to it a holomorphic germ. Blue is holomorphic, because after that, we know that we just evaluated the zero and we're done. So we might sometimes look at this intermediate step with a straight E, the other one is rounded. That's why I put map for this, form for that. But in the end, that's what we want. Okay? Now, up to now, I said nothing, so we could have taken anything. But there is something we want, that it extends the ordinary evaluation at zero when things converge, when things are holomorphic. Otherwise, we're doing things completely ad hoc. So here on holomorphic germs, it should be the identity. That's a choice. We could have done something else. But that's for us important. For the rounded evaluator, the one that we're really interested in, it should just evaluate at zero when things are holomorphic at zero. Now, we're going to define Q generalized evaluators, because we can't do things so naively, because then we have no trace anymore of, you know, all the effort we made to separate. And now we're going to bring that back into the game with a Q. The Q helped us separate. So it's the same definition. You'll see it's a copy-paste up to the fact, very important fact, that we ask that when two functions have nothing to do with each other, they should be, the evaluator should factorize. This is, again, reminiscent of locality. This looks like, you know, not so essential, but it makes the big difference. So that's what we call Q generalized evaluators, and again, they depend on Q. So, as you see, this result we got simultaneously to Nicole Berlin and Michel Verne, it's just a splitting of our space of meromorphic germs using this Q in a product, we can split, and we already saw that in the Laurent expansion I gave you, into the holomorphic part, which was the small h, and the dustbin, which is the M minus, okay? The polar germs, that was the dustbin. And this is thanks to this Q, which enabled us to do that. So the previous version I gave you, this Laurent expansion, was a refined version of this theorem. Now, because this is unique, this decomposition is unique, I told you what is in the dustbin is not unique, but this decomposition as a whole is unique. We can project onto the holomorphic part. We've got a device now to project, and that's what I was telling you at the beginning. This is minimal subtraction. Now that we were careful enough to know how to separate things, we can just be naive again and project. Now, this is what we call a locality morphism. Locality morphism means it respects, it factorizes over independent elements, over independent functions. Having done that, then this lands in holomorphic germs, we can evaluate, and we get a Q generalized evaluator. Because this respected this locality that I put in the previous slide, this one will do as well. And this is, okay, maybe I should, oh, sorry, this is not what I wanted to do. So I'm a bit lost. I wanted to go to the previous slide, yes. So this EQ that we're now going to we've just defined respects this multiplicativity relation, and we call that a locality morphism. Okay. Evaluators a la sphere do not do that. That's why it took us some time to understand what was really happening. It's not a Q generalized evaluator. What does he do? He evaluates. He has separate variables, z1, zk. He takes a finite part in z1, then in z2, then in z3, etc. But this will not respect locality, if you don't fit things carefully with the evaluator. So this is not a Q-generalized evaluator, this shows you. You can do that, let me see what. So you take first Z1 equals zero, you get minus Z2 over Z2. This is minus one. Whereas if you do it the way we did it, this is irreducible, you throw it away, it's zero. Okay, so it's not compatible. Okay, so now cones versus fractions. I told you that we were replacing these Riesz type or regularization by a Laplace type regularization. So we're looking at the Laplace transform of a simplicial cone. So this is our simplicial cone generated by VI. Here you would have E1, E1 plus E2, and you take an exponential function. I've put a minus here. This doesn't matter. It's just to point out that it's Schwarz, so that a cone is, of course, infinite, and you take a Schwarz function. And if you have a simplicial cone, so something with linearly independent vectors, you can just write this as a product. So this is very easy. And now this makes you see how these poles, linear poles arise. You just integrate. This is an integration that is very familiar to physicists that comes up all the time, and you get your linear poles. This is going from cones to fractions, but we can go the other way because we saw that already. We went from fractions to cones because we said to every fraction, we associated some cones, if you remember. And that's what we do here. We do it the other way. Take a fraction and associate the cone. This is doable when the cone is simplicial. Namely, Li of epsilon is this form, and the VIs come up here. Simplicial just means that the VIs are linearly independent. And so now we're going to consider something a little more sophisticated. This was when there's no power here. If there's a power, we define for that a decorated cone. So we could go from cones to fractions. And if we have fractions with multiplicity in the denominator, we end up with what we call decorated cones. This will be useful for what follows. Now, so let us evaluate. We said we knew how to evaluate with these generalized evaluators. Let's see whether we can indeed do that. So I take a polar germ. I take one of these generalized evaluators, and I use the simple rule that it is multiplicative on independent sets of variables. So remember, for polar germ, this has nothing to do with that. So the evaluator factorizes because that's what it was made for. Okay, is that okay? But also the evaluator evaluates on holomorphic functions at zero. So this is zero. This was also the second rule. And so there's no choice. This thing is completely determined by its value on these poles, specific poles. And since we assign to these poles decorated cones, we can say that any Q-generalized evaluator on polar germs is determined by the value on the supporting cones. Okay? So this becomes now geometric, a geometric interpretation that generalized evaluators are determined by their values on supporting cones. So let's see how this goes for. Here we had a polar germ. Let's take a general germ. But we know, thanks to this Laurent expansion, we could split it into a sum of polar germs. This was not unique, remember, but doesn't matter. And epsilon of H, which this was unique. Now, we look at our recipe. So we've got many of these. We've got a big a number of these parameterized by Sj, And we apply to each of them the recipe we had here. So we have an Hj of zero and this. And this is also determined, no choice, because the evaluator on holomorphic germs just evaluates at zero. So again, on general meromorphic germs, the evaluator is completely determined by this part. So this leads us to this theorem that Q generalized evaluators on general meromorphic germs are determined by their values on the subfamily of decorated supporting cones. So why is that interesting, we think? Because I think it should help us understand the renormalization group better in a very abstract sense, because we don't only have, we have no physical theory. What we want to generalize, what we want to understand is the relation between different evaluators, the values obtained by different evaluators. Remember, the Q inner product was one of the ingredients, but it's not the only one. So we're first, that's what we're working on now, thinking about what's so special about the orthogonality relation. Can it be generalized? Yes, it can. So we're defining more general, what we call regular locality relation. And this brings us to try to think what's special about orthogonality. It splits something. You can take the orthogonal in a Euclidean space of a subspace, and this splits your space. And so there is a notion of orthogonal complement, which we generalize to a complement map. This was already looked at by Garoufaladis, I hope I get his name right, and Pommersheim. In the context, Pommersheim, in the context of polytopes. Polytopes are just intersections of cones, so it's no wonder. And it's also motivated by equivariant geometry. I think Garoufaladis is a considers himself as a geometer, I would think. They already had this notion of complement map for other reasons, and we find it's very relevant for a renormalization. For those of you who are familiar with the co-product, with the Birkhoff-Hopf factorization that was developed by, well, at least, yes, proposed by Kohn and Kreimer to deal, to reinterpret the forest formula in quantum field theory. What do? They take a subdiagram and then they kind of take a complement to this subdiagram. The co-product separates a partial product from the rest. So there's, in fact, there is a very strong relation between taking a complement and building a co-product. Most of the co-products, not all, are built like that. You take something and you combine it with its complement to build a co-product. So it's the separating device. Now, we think that the Galois group of automorphisms of meromorphic germs at zero that are the identity on the holomorphic part, that those play a role. they act clearly on generalized evaluators. Why do they act? Because remember, a generalized evaluator, we decided that the straight E, that it would leave holomorphic germs invariant. It's the identity. And the only freedom we have is the rest, and that's what we saw in, no, that's not what I wanted to do. In the previous slide, where the only freedom we have is this, yeah? This is fixed. All this is, all the blue is fixed because the evaluators, their task is to generalize the usual evaluation at zero. So on holomorphic germs, they have no choice. That's why we think that the Galois group of automorphisms of meromorphic germs that are the identity on holomorphic germs should play a central role. And we view them as acting on generalized evaluators. Now, to go from one inner product to another, a very natural way is to implement a linear transformation. So the linear transformations also act on generalized evaluators. And there, the two groups kind of come across each other. So we're in the process of exploring this. So this is all for today, and let me give you some references, a few. So I've put only those which are directly related to the content of this talk, but I could have put quite a few, like these, Nicole Bernin and Michel Verne's papers, that really served as a very strong motivation. Thank you very much.
Any questions? Let's ask one of the speakers. What's up? Students?
Just a simple question. When you keep the Q relation, the orthogonal relation between the homomorphic functions, the germ functions, like you keep calling it a relation, I felt you could, that could only be a partial relation, could only say between two functions, like if they are orthogonal, then,
yes.
Like, can you prove that relation was transitive, in a sense? Because it felt like it was just...
No, think of orthogonality. It's not transitive.
Yeah. So it's not a relation, it's just a... So, okay.
In fact, this relation, it's a good question, this relation is very simple.
Okay.
It's a binary, symmetric relation. That's all.
Okay.
No, if you think of orthogonality, you see that it shouldn't be transitive. But symmetric, in fact, is a luxury. We don't really need it, but in practice, it's what we need is symmetric. So Kasia, who's there, has investigated in a paper, which I is on archive, the relation with causality, where there you have to be a little more careful about symmetry, because causality is not quite symmetric, but she could relate this notion of locality, which I haven't dwelled on here, because that could be just a talk on its own, but it relates it to causality in quantum field theory. So another example is disjointness of sets, or transversality of manifolds. You see, things that say that things are separate, and for example, also for wavefront sets which deal with singularities, transversality is very important of the underlying manifolds. So things like that.
Any questions for students? For general audience?
So the last comment about the randomization group. Well, there is this notion of randomization group of Stuckelberg, Petermann, but also pursued by Brunetti, Frenhagen, and Deutsch, where you kind of describe the randomization group underlying Epstein-Glaser randomization, right? So is your randomization group that you kind of are looking for in terms of these evaluators somewhat related to that?
I'm not sure, because I don't think I'm familiar enough with that one, that point of view. But what I can tell you is that we're looking at it from a quite different point of view, I suppose, because so we have So we have the physical model, and we have the meromorphic functions. In fact, C infinity. And I think what you're looking at, what you're thinking of is here. Now we have whatever, for example, Feynman integrals, or it could be if we're not in a physical model, but any model, so here any model, sums or whatever. And we're looking at things here. So we're looking at how things relate, a group acting here.
But this should be very much related, because...
Should be.
Stuckelberg-Petermann group acts on the space of models, so to say. So you have an action on the space of Lagrangians, right? It is the kind of models. And since there is this map to that other guy, then one action should somehow be tied to the other. That's just a conjecture.
Yeah, so we should be able to invert this map, which I don't think we can, I'm not sure we can do that, you see?
Well, yeah, invert or like almost invert up to something.
Okay, that would be interesting to investigate.
You know, there must be some relation.
It would be nice. So we still don't quite know what group we're talking about yet, but because it's complex, but that seems to emerge at least. And we claim that since it's acting here, it's quite universal. There should be something universal about it. But it's maybe too much too big. I think.
What is the significance of figure Q?
The inner product? Say it again, the Q.
Chosen to be Lorentzian or Minkowski?
Ours is a Euclidean inner product, but so Kasha didn't quite formulate, because in your approach, then you probably would need something Minkowskian, but it didn't arise. Because you were not so much, yes, in your paper you look at locality and not evaluators.
Yeah, I mean, I think when you replace this locality with causality and you don't have a symmetric relation, then you can allow for things like the Lorentz approach. Because I think what you're talking about is like very Euclidean in nature.
Yes.
But there might be a possibility.
Yes and no, because be careful, again, this Q is here.
Yeah.
So it has nothing to do, well, it has something to do. This reflects in some way where it comes from, but it's the space-time is not, it's here, it's not there. We kind of close our eyes once we're there.
Okay, so maybe what lives on that side, yeah.
Yeah. So what we think is something that we cannot prove, that the pole structure here reflects the constraints there, which we observe in practice, but we cannot prove it. You see that the diagrammatic nature of Feynman integrals is reflected in the poles, etc. But that's all that remains, more or less.
Somehow you get more singular things when you work with Lorentzian signature, right? Because what would normally be always positive as the denominator in Euclidean would not always be positive in Lorentzian. So I think it's a bit more subtle because you have more poles.
Yeah, but then you see, I give you the work to show me that what the poles are, and then I apply my theory. It's not my work. It's not my job. So you don't think they would be linear? That would be new.
No, I think they would be linear.
That's right. So anyone think here that have you come across poles that are not linear?
I think you might want to look at the thesis of Kai Keller, who was looking at this kind of regularization with multiple complex parameters. So he actually worked through a complete example. Kai Keller.
Ah, yeah, we did look at that. Yeah. We did look at that.
Yeah,
but there's nobody who's proved, really, that they're always linear. But I would be very interested.
It's a good conjecture.
Yeah?
I think it's very plausible that they are all linear.
Yes, but it would be nice to have this meta theorem which says why they're linear, because okay. Well, it's an open question for you.
Any more questions?
You showed this simple example for your evaluator, where you evaluated this very simple rational function. But do you have an algorithm to evaluate an arbitrary function, a given function, then how to evaluate it?
Yeah, that question was asked to me before. So I think Nicole Berlin and Michel Vern, when they had very similar things to do, but in fact, they use the Birkhoff-Hopf type factorization, if I'm not mistaken. And they claimed it was fast. I'm no good at doing that. I haven't looked into that, but we should.
Something like that.
Well, we haven't worked out on this at all, but I think, yes, I think it's quite a fast method. If you fix your inner product and you implement that, I understand from what they investigated that it's quite fast, but I can't say more because I haven't looked into it.
But your Galois group seemed very interesting. So it was the automorphisms of the metamorphic germs, which were sort of the homomorphic germs. But automorphisms as what? Preserving what structure?
So they have to preserve the linearity of the, and so, yeah, I didn't say. So they have, on so meromorphic germs with this locality relation that I pointed out to you, orthogonality, build a locality algebra. And they have to preserve that.
Okay, so it's some algebraic structure weaker than a field.
You call it weaker, I call it stronger. Well, you ask for more, yeah. You ask it.
If it preserves the field structure, everything is the identity, because it's diffraction.
No. It just preserves this locality. So it's preserves the locality algebra structure.
So is it possible to write down and to understand this group in any concrete sense?
Write
down some elements in some non-trivial elements of this group.
What are the elements in that group? Yes, we can't yet describe it all, otherwise we'd understand it. It's difficult. And especially, in fact, this brings to another question. This is not too difficult. What's difficult is, in practice, you have subalgebras of this algebra of meromorphic germs with a certain type of pose. There we've had difficulties defining the Galois group for those. This we don't know how to do. And that's the one we would really need, because you see we have specific types of poles in practice. That's very difficult. So we're still, this is the beginning, very beginning.
Any more questions? You can text me again.